Hey, podcast listeners, it's Anne Strainchamps from To the Best of Our Knowledge. And today we've got some ideas about evolution that might just blow your mind. Okay, maybe not if you're a biologist, but let me explain. What most of us learned in school is that evolution and the process of natural selection gave us all these nifty biological advantages, you know, like teeth and eyes and opposable thumbs, not to mention a neocortex. But that's just how evolution works at the most basic level. At higher levels, you could say evolution also gave us Donald Trump, global warming, and debates about immigration. Really.
What's good for me can be bad for my family. What's good for my family can be bad for my clan. What's good for my clan can be bad for my nation. What's good for a nation can be bad for the planet. Okay?
This is David Sloan Wilson. He's an evolutionary biologist at Binghamton University and a senior scholar with the Center for Humans and Nature. He's a pioneer in a theory of evolution called group selection, which is an idea that, if you follow it all the way, leads to some other ideas that you might be surprised to hear from a scientist.
Increasingly, I'm thinking of the world as sacred. I used to disparage the Gaia hypothesis. Because it just ain't true. The Earth is not a goddess. But could the Earth become a goddess? Could the Earth become a superorganism if we did the right thing?
So today, Steve Paulson is going to introduce us to David Sloan Wilson, and they're going to work their way up to this idea. But they're going to start with David's backstory, which maybe explains a bit about where his ideas come from.
David, I want to take you back to your childhood. Your father, Sloan Wilson, was a best-selling novelist, probably most famous for his book, The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit, which was published in 1955, became one of the great cultural artifacts of the 50s, showing the emptiness of corporate culture and the company man. How old were you when that book came out?
Well, I was born in 1949, so that would have made me six, I guess.
Okay.
And that book was followed by A Summer Place, which was also his second iconic book. He wrote about 13 books, but I was definitely growing up when he was at the height of his fame, and that was formative for me.
Were you very aware of his stature as a novelist?
I was, for better or for worse. He was just the center of attention wherever he went. His fame as a novelist trumped everything. It trumped money. It trumped pedigree. His son could not help but notice that.
So you said it was formative, for better or worse. How so?
I think all sons feel this way about their fathers, that it's kind of a benchmark, something that you need to meet. In his case, it was very daunting. So I loved my father. I respected him. But the idea of matching what he did was daunting. And so I think it sent me on a trajectory in which I wanted to do something that he could respect, but that would not be directly comparable to him. And to this day, I think that's why I became a scientist.
As opposed to a novelist.
Right. And at the same time, sharing the novelistic vision and also a love of writing. Once I gained my independence and self-confidence, then I could more or less tack back to something like what he did. So I do love to write.
Have you ever tried writing fiction?
Or you want to know the truth?
I think that's a yes, but it remains unpublished.
Well, I might as well announce it to the world. I am writing a sequel to Atlas Shrugged.
Are you serious?
I am serious.
Are you an Ayn Rand fan?
No. This will be the antidote. This will be the antidote to Atlas Shrugged. I'll even tell you the title.
Okay.
Is everyone ready for this?
Yeah.
Atlas Hugged.
Wait, and this is a novel?
Yes, I'm
writing a
novel.
You're serious. This is not a joke.
Yes, I'm serious.
That's hilarious. And is it going to be 1,000 pages also, or however long her book was?
It will be shorter and better written. That book lives not because of the writing ability, I can assure you of that.
Right. Yeah. Oh, that's very funny. So why did you become a scientist?
Well, from an early age, I remember telling my father, you know, I'm going to be a scientist. And for me, that meant I was going to cure cancer. I was going to wear a white lab coat. At the same time, I've always had a love of nature and was lucky growing up to be able to experience nature. Not where we lived during the school year, but we had a summer place. And the summer place was 600 acres on the north end of Lake George that used to be a hotel. My father's family operated one of the Adirondack hotels. And it was dismantled after World War II, but the grounds and the cottages on the grounds remained as a kind of a club. So every summer, we would go and we would spend two glorious months on the north end of Lake George, just fishing and swimming and climbing the mountains and so on. And so this is firmly imprinted upon my being.
And were you kind of a budding naturalist, sort of observing the animals that were in the lake or whatever?
I was an avid fisherman. I was kind of a solitary. I enjoyed being by myself. And so I was a very patient fisherman, so endless hours patrolling the docks, fishing for bass and so on. So to cut a long story short, it took a little while, but as soon as I realized that I could be a scientist who studies nature, in other words, an ecologist, then that's what I knew I was going to do. That was in my sophomore year in college is when I knew what I was going to do. I was going to be an ecologist.
And were there any particular scientific questions that you were especially drawn to?
That part was serendipity. And so more or less just by chance, I did a project on a vertical migration in zooplankton. It was like throwing a dart at a dartboard. It could have been any other thing. So at that point, by the time I graduated from college, I was intending to be an aquatic ecologist, and I went to Michigan State University to get my PhD.
Now, since then, you have become a pioneer in the evolutionary theory of group selection. And this is quite controversial. I mean, a lot of debate among scientists. It seems to cut directly against Richard Dawkins' idea of the selfish gene. Tell me what the nature of this debate is. What's the argument here?
Well, before, let me just say a little more about when I entered graduate education. Was an interesting time in history because it was a time when ecology and evolution and behavior, which were all separate traditions, were fusing. And nowadays at universities and biology departments, there's the acronym EEB, Ecology, Evolution, Behavior, all fused into a single subject. And I was there at the right moment, basically, for that to happen. And so that more or less turned me from an aquatic ecologist who might have studied zooplankton for the rest of my life to an anything ecologist who could study any trait in any species. So on altruism, I encountered that as an undergraduate and at a time when it was very controversial. This was a time when the idea that altruism might evolve by a process of group selection was being rejected.
And just to back up for a moment, when we talk about group selection, that the question is whether evolution can actually work at the group level, not just at the individual organism level or even at the level of genes. We're talking about whether it can work at this sort of this larger, higher level.
Well, to go back to the beginning, Darwin originally thought that his theory of natural selection could explain all aspects of design that were being attributed to a creator. But he soon realized a problem, that when he thought about the traits associated with morality and being good for the group, so this would be bravery, loyalty, altruism, everything that involves benefiting others or one's group as a whole at some personal cost, then he realized that a Darwinian process, selection among individuals, would weigh against those traits. Selfishness beats altruism, you might say. And so this was, of course, a great concern because it meant that although he might explain the exquisite design of individuals, he could not explain how a social group might function as a corporate union. So that was the problem that required a solution. And the solution, Darwin saw, all of this from the very beginning, is that while selfishness might beat altruism within groups, a group of altruists would robustly beat a group of selfish individuals. And so he began to think about natural selection as a process that could operate between groups and could act as a counterforce to selection within groups, which would be weighing in favor of selfishness in all of its forms.
So that all makes sense. The problem is, how do you actually explain that scientifically when presumably evolution operates at the level of genes, right?
Well, no, and I need to educate you, my friend.
Okay.
That's the dogma which has persisted ever since. I want to say this is so past tense.
Really? I'm not sure that everyone would agree with that. Well, I know you think that the theory of group selection is won out, but you have your critics.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of sociology of science here that we can discuss. And we need to distinguish between what we fondly call the peer-reviewed literature, the people that think enough about it so that when they write something, it passes the peer review process, okay? And other folks. I'm not disparaging those other folks, but nevertheless, if you go to the peer review literature, and I want to say that excludes Richard Dawkins, who has not contributed to the peer reviewed literature on this topic for many a decade. It excludes Steven Pinker, who, as famous as he is in other domains, has not contributed anything to the peer review literature on this topic.
And yet those are two of the biggest names that we read when if we try to come to some
exactly.
understanding about
so
evolution.
Shame on you, the listening public. Why is it that we have these icons and so few of them? There's Dawkins, there's Pinker, there's the other Wilson.
E.O. Wilson.
E.O. Wilson. And of course, they're magnificent scientists. They deserve credit for what they have done. But then they acquire this iconic status so that anything they say is taken as gospel. And depending on the individual, they either resist the temptation to sound off on everything or they don't. So that's where it stands. And decades are required for the dust to settle. But if we confine ourselves to the peer-reviewed literature, then I claim that the dust has settled, and I can defend that claim.
Okay, so what is the scientific case that evolution really does happen at the level of the group, which would explain why there are cooperative groups and why there is altruism?
I could give you many examples in nature, in the laboratory, in which this dynamic, basically selection, weighing in favor of selfishness within groups, weighing in favor of altruism between groups. And what you get depends on the strength of those two forces. Sometimes selfishness wins out, sometimes altruism wins out. Very often you get a mix. So the mystery, I think, in retrospect is, why did this become heretical? Okay? Mm-hmm. And we could spend a little time on this, if you like, shall we?
Yeah, sure. You mean the whole notion that the natural selection at the group level?
Why was rejected as
right.
definitively
yeah.
as
yes.
it was?
Uh-huh.
And the idea that the gene is the fundamental unit of selection has something to do with this. Starting with George C. Williams, not Dawkins, this concept of the gene as some kind of a fundamental unit began to be articulated. And there is a sense in which the gene is a fundamental unit of selection, if you'd like to put it that way. But it says nothing whatsoever about group selection. In a group selection model, we have altruists and non-altruists. It's assumed that they both have a genetic basis. Mm-hmm. We assume that there's a gene for altruism and a gene for selfishness. The question is, how can that gene for altruism evolve? Group selection is the answer to that question. And when group selection happens and the altruistic gene evolves, then that gene is more fit than the selfish gene, all things considered. So the whole fallacy that the gene is the fundamental unit of selection, therefore this constitutes some kind of argument against group selection, which began with Williams and then was amplified by Dawkins, is fallacious. It's naive gene selectionism, and it persists to this day, not amongst the intelligentsia, not among the cognoscenti, but among so many others.
Do you think most evolutionary biologists would agree with what you've just said?
Yes.
Okay. What is at stake here? Is this just a debate among scientists about how evolution works, or are there bigger ideas at stake?
There's definitely bigger ideas at stake. When we look back at evolution in Darwin's day, we see that it was thoroughly embedded in Victorian culture. And a lot of ideas that we have ended up rejecting, especially ideas about such things as cultural evolution as a linear progression from savages to civilization, things like this, were just so deep in the bones of Victorian culture that nobody could see past them, not Darwin, not any of his associates. Well, that also operates today. And I think that when you look at that period of time, the middle of the 20th century, then it is, you could call it the age of individualism. It reflected itself in economics, in the social sciences, and in popular culture. So when Margaret Thatcher said there's no such thing as society, only individuals and their families, what moved her to say that? So what you can see is that this individualistic swing in evolutionary theory is part of this more general cultural trend.
So, I mean, you're really saying that the fundamental debate, I mean, it sort of, it gets at this profound question, are humans more good or bad? Or to put it another way, are they more selfish or cooperative? I mean, that's really what's
yes,
at stake
it is.
Here.
Yes, it is. And actually, we should get quickly to the human condition because, of course, it's so important. It's so important there. And you cannot think about the human condition, including current events, without thinking about multi-level selection. I'm sorry, you can't. And my colleagues who are in the middle of this don't. It is certainly prevailing among them.
You have to explain this. What does this have to do with current events?
Because, I mean, the basic dynamic of multi-level selection is that for a given entity, a group of any size, to function adaptively, for the members to coordinate themselves, requires a process of selection at that level. So let me unpack this. What's good for me can be bad for my family. What's good for my family can be bad for my clan. What's good for my clan can be bad for my nation. What's good for my political party can be bad for my nation. What's good for me can be bad for my corporation. What's good for my corporation can be bad for the global economy. What's good for a nation can be bad for the planet. Okay? So all of these processes, selection processes that are operating at lower levels, make trouble, are disruptive at higher levels. And so you can see this operating today all around us. Almost every problem we have is basically a manifestation of selection operating at lower levels, creating problems higher up the scale. That's why we're in the middle of it. And if you can't see that, then there's so much you cannot see.
My guest is David Sloan Wilson, president of the Evolution Institute and author of the book, Does Altruism Exist? Just ahead, we'll talk about the evolution of religion and why David, a diehard atheist, has come to appreciate spirituality and sacred experiences. If we're talking about the evolutionary process, cultural evolution is part of that, right? I mean, it's not just that biological evolution is real evolution and what happens culturally as we learn through the course of civilization, that's something more ephemeral. Your cultural evolution is part of the whole thing?
Yeah. Evolution has three basic ingredients, a variation, selection, and some mechanism of inheritance. And these ingredients hold for our cultural traits, basically. Now what we need to do and what is being done, it's part of the Renaissance that I'm talking about, is to go back to basics. And to think about evolution in terms of heredity, not genes, in which case other mechanisms of inheritance exist. And there's at least three. One is epigenetics, changes in gene expression, not gene frequency. The other is forms of social learning found in many species. Many species have cultural traditions. The fourth is forms of symbolic thought that are distinctively human.
You're talking about something like the written language.
The written language plus much more. And basically, with symbolic thought, you have mental representations which are decoupled from what's actually out there. So what this means is that everything that has been regarded as outside the orbit of evolutionary theory, the typical partitioning up until now has been that evolution is about genes, biology. It explains our physical bodies and a few basic urges, such as to eat and to have sex. And then everything else, our rich behavioral and cultural diversity, that's about learning and culture, and that's outside the orbit of evolutionary theory. That's the typical partitioning that has existed in the human-related disciplines. Now, all of that stuff that was outside the orbit has been brought inside the orbit. And that is so cool.
Huh. So I want to come back to this question of what's at stake, because you're suggesting that an entirely new theory of what it means to be human is really what we're talking about. And maybe, actually, we are more wired, I don't know if that's the right word, to be cooperative, to be giving, to be altruistic than scientists traditionally have thought, at least for the last couple of centuries?
Yeah, absolutely. So let me unpack that a little bit. And this is what makes us so different from other primate species, is all about multi-level selection. A major concept called major transitions didn't begin until the 1970s with Lynn Margulis, who proposed the then radical theory that nucleated cells did not evolve by small mutational steps from bacterial cells, but evolved as symbiotic communities of bacteria. And so the idea that a group becomes an organism because their members become so cooperative, that was the first instance of that. And then it wasn't until the 1990s that that was generalized to other examples in which groups become so cooperative that they become a new higher-level organism. Everything that we call an organism today is a product of not one but several major transitions, multicellular organisms, nucleated cells, possibly even the origin of life as groups of cooperating molecular reactions, social insect colonies, and our species. And so the conjecture is that in our species, our ancestors found ways to suppress disruptive self-serving behaviors within groups, causing teamwork, basically, to become the dominating evolutionary force. So cooperation, working effectively as groups, this is the signature adaptation of our species. And that includes, I want to emphasize, cooperation plus more. It's not that we're just became so terribly nice. The way that this works is that we're able to hold each other in check. And so policing is huge. Such things as reputation is huge. And in a typical primate colony, the dominant individual is the biggest, baddest individual. In human hunter-gatherer societies, the dominant individual is the one that has the best reputation. And the only way to get that reputation is to do well by others. The entire criterion for dominance has been shifted. Not entirely.
Right, you still have the tyrant who can, you know, rule over the clan.
I said before that multi-level selection results in a mix. And that mix also exists within each and every one of us because we're flexible and we're like poker players, basically. We can play the altruism card or we can play the selfish card. And so the groups that work well today, your group, my group, if you look at them and if you look at their social organization, it's because they are protective against disruptive self-serving behavior. And then knowing that, the ones that want to be pro-social can safely do so without fear of being exploited. And anyone bent on being disruptive and self-serving, well, they won't have a very easy time of it.
So I think you're raising a potentially a very significant question here. Is human evolution moving towards being more pro-social?
This has been a back and forth for the last 10,000 years. And
so we're not necessarily, I mean, humanity at large is not necessarily sort of more cooperative now than we were 5,000 years ago.
No, it is.
So it's not just back and forth.
There's been a net effect, but there's been plenty of backs. I mean, it's like two steps forward, one step back, and the past does not predict the future. We could get apocalyptic collapse. It's perfectly possible. There's nothing preventing it.
Now, I read recently an essay that you wrote about the Jesuit priest Teilhard de Chardin, who had some very unorthodox ideas about all kinds of things. And he was also a noted paleontologist. So he sort of, he wore these two hats.
He was a respected scientist of his day and a Jesuit priest.
And he had this kind of crazy idea that human evolution was evolving towards some kind of global consciousness.
Right.
You like Teilhard de Chardin, don't you?
Yeah, with one big caveat. So I read him in 2009, the year of Darwin. And I was traveling all over the world to Darwin events, including one at the Vatican, which was memorable. And so in preparation for that, I just thought I would do my homework and read The Phenomenon of Man, his best-known book. And I was actually astonished at how prescient he was. He actually got so much right in terms of multi-level selection and cultural evolution. So he asked us to imagine tiny grains of thought, this basically small-scale society, coalescing. He's right about that. But the idea that this would continue and that this would result in some form of global consciousness called the Omega Point is what is the caveat, basically. And I'm here to say that actually is theoretically possible, but there's nothing inevitable about it, and it's something we must steer towards. And whether we can get there or not, we'll never get there if we don't steer towards it. So in numerous essays, actually, with other like-minded people, we're using the phrase steering towards the omega point. And a point to make here is everything we've talked about today is straight-up science. Happy to say I'm 100% atheist, although with a caveat there, too.
Which I'm going to come to in a moment.
But also spiritual thinkers and holistic thinkers are also reaching in this direction. And there's a wonderful union of people coming from a spiritual and many religious traditions, along with scientists such as myself, are coming together. And the spiritual element being very important.
Okay, let me jump in here. You said you're 100% atheist. You're not especially anti-religion, though, I sense.
I study religion as a human construction. And as a human construction, I have great respect for many religions, because religions, as Durkheim perceived long, long ago, are very good at forming community. And that's a good thing. So
you're saying that there are evolutionary explanations for why religion has persisted?
Oh, totally. I mean, all elements of religion as human constructions can be explained from an evolutionary perspective.
So this is not just about believing in supernatural things to explain, you know, weird phenomena in the world.
Well, the reason that religion is so puzzling to the scientific and rational imagination is that it involves counterfactual beliefs in things for which there's no evidence, and practices that seem costly and non-utilitarian. So we can understand why we make blankets, but we can't understand why we burn them in sacrifice to unseen gods. And there's two answers to that puzzle. One is that religions are just as irrational and unuseful as they seem, in which case we're stuck with trying to explain how can something exist that's not adaptive. Now, that's definitely part of the evolutionary wheelhouse. Stephen Jay Gould and others were there to tell us not everything that evolves is adaptive. Plenty of stuff is out there that's not adaptive. There might be byproducts, there might be this, there might be that. So this is one class of explanation for a religious phenomenon. The other possibility is that these beliefs and practices are useful after all. Now, these two classes of explanation have been debated by religious scholars from the beginning of religious scholarship. Fast forward to the present, I think the commencement of evolutionists such as myself asking the same questions has made enormous progress and has settled the issue more than the previous century of religious scholarship. I want to boast.
You're saying it settled it because you're showing that actually religion has all kinds of benefits to bring a group
together. Not me. I mean, not just me. My book, Darwin's Cathedral, developed this thesis at the same time that other books were coming out, such as Pascal Boyer's Religion Explained, Scott Atran's In God We Trust. Basically, these were evolutionists pursuing these different hypotheses. And now there's a consensus that most enduring religions, and not just religions, but most enduring meaning systems, are impressively adaptive at the group level. And so this is one reason why I'm a severe critic of the new, so-called new atheists. I'm with them when they say there's no evidence for supernatural agent, but I am not with them when they portray religion as a human construction, as bad, bad, bad. That's bad on them, because they're really not functioning as scientists. And by the way, they don't contribute to the peer review literature. They're functioning in ideological mode. They're fundamentalist in their own way. So just about everything problematic that we associate with religion, such as belief in stuff that's not out there, of course, all the nasty between group stuff, that exists for secular worldviews and meaning systems just as much. So it's very important for us to see the big picture of meaning systems, and then religion is one kind of meaning system.
We just have a few minutes left, but I want to come back to you personally. Now, you've said you're an atheist. Would you say you have any spiritual leanings?
Yeah, and I would have said no. I would have leaned towards no, actually, until quite recently, and now I'm leaning more and more towards yes, in part because of my interactions with spiritually inclined people. And I do love to think about all these words that seem otherworldly. Religion, God, spirituality, all these words, sacred.
So those are meaningful words to you.
Well, they're meaningful words to all of us, and that's why we use them. And these are important words, and that's why they're used all the time. They're used in religious context, but they're used all the time in non-religious context. Whenever a word is used, that's signaling that it's doing important work. What is it about something like sacred or spiritual and so on and so forth? And once you do that, as long as I stay within the boundary of methodological naturalism, if I can find strong definitions of something like spirituality, religion, sacred, so on and so forth, I feel fully comfortable using those.
Well, let me put it a different way. I mean, do you feel like you've had sacred experiences in your own life?
Yeah, I have. And the way you frame the question, did the skies part? No. That I have some kind of revelatory experience. Some people do.
Mm-hmm.
Not me. No.
So what has been sacred for you personally at some deep, I don't know, emotional or maybe intellectual level?
So the concept of sacred, basically, when something is sacred, it dominates you. If you regard something as sacred, then basically you become subservient to it. You place yourself under it. When something is profane, then you use it as a tool. So increasingly, I'm thinking of the world as sacred. The earth is sacred. I used to disparage the Gaia hypothesis because it just ain't true. The earth is not a goddess. But could the earth become a goddess? This is what it means to evolve, to steer towards the Omega point. Could the earth become a superorganism if we did the right things? Should we work towards that? And if we do, then basically, whether we use the words or not, we are treating the earth as sacred. And if we want to call it a goddess that only comes into being through our participation, we can do so. I don't see anything wrong with that. And it might be helpful, although not necessary. We could stay in scientific mode, you know, but to actually use the language that the earth is a goddess, that there's such a thing as a god that actually does exist or actually doesn't exist but can be brought into being if we do the right things, this is a strong narrative. It's very spiritual, and there's nothing wrong with it that I can see as a scientist.
That is an excellent place to leave it. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Yeah, that was great.
Steve Paulson talking with David Sloan Wilson, who's president of the Evolution Institute and a biologist at Binghamton University. This episode was produced in partnership with the Center for Humans and Nature. The center brings together scholars from a diversity of disciplines to think creatively about our relationships with nature and each other. You can also read David Sloan Wilson's essay on evolution and altruism and share your own thoughts at humansandnature.org. On our next episode, what can evolution teach us about love? It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI.
PRI, Public Radio International.